Adlai Stevenson one time when he was addressing the graduate students and the faculty at Princeton University began by saying, I've been invited to come and speak to you for a while. You've been invited to come and listen for a while. But the best I can hope is that we all finish at approximately the same time. I would like to try and talk for a while. If I know Holden in matters such as this, I won't get too far. But this is to be an exploration of what the mindset and what the assumptions are of us as members of the rich world. At most, I would like to talk until about a quarter of. But if you have some things to say along the way, please jump right in. And then, since my back is to the clock, at a quarter of, if we aren't already into a discussion, someone wave a hand or stomp or throw a chair or ring the bell or do something so that we reserve at least a full half hour for a general give and take. I may not, despite Chuck's announcement, get to some of the theological factors that have influenced the mindset and the assumptions of the rich today. We certainly will in later sessions. I want today to describe a course of the rich in the West that I think has shaped our values and our assumptions. Harold, in the discussion of the film, wanted us to sort out some things that were getting all lumped together, the mission enterprise and the way of life of the rich generally. And he suspected, I think, that we were clustering all sorts of things together that needed to be sorted out. I want to say that while I think that's true, I think it's also true that there is a set of assumptions and a value constellation that informs the church of the rich and the church's presence in the poor country, as well as of the whole of the secular enterprise and the way of the life of the rich in general. Now, as I say in the part of the country where I teach, I'd like you all to listen up a bit to a paragraph from Abraham Lincoln's Thanksgiving Day address in the war year, 1863. Needful diversions of wealth and of strength from the fields of peaceful industry to the national defense have not arrested the plow, the shuttle, or the ship. The axe has enlarged the borders of our settlement, and the mines, as well of iron and coal as of precious metals, have yielded even more abundantly than before. Population has steadily increased, notwithstanding the waste that has been made in the camp, the siege, and the battlefield. And the country, rejoicing in the consciousness of augmented strength and vigor, is permitted to expect continuance of years of large increase of freedom. No human counsel hath devised, nor hath any mortal hand worked out these great things. They are the gracious gift of the Most High God, who, while dealing with us in anger for our sins, hath nevertheless remembered mercy. That wasn't the last time that an American president would assure us that we could have both guns and butter, nor the last time that a president would find in our material expansiveness evidence of the workings of the Almighty. I think Lincoln was a little surprised at how much we could attain with expanded material growth. And with Lincoln, it actually starts before, but it proceeds through the last century, there is generated, especially in America, but it becomes a Western phenomenon in general, a fantastic optimism. And a value system that comes with what in effect is a 200-year boom. And that optimism that rides a couple of centuries of expanded material growth continues until, I think, in the middle of the 1970s. I think we're right now in the midst of the coming apart of that. And I want to contend that a value system, a mindset, is generated and shaped by that. Despite convulsive episodes, turbulent decades, despite wars and rumors of wars, despite times of inflation, depression, and unemployment, the level of material output soared. the Industrial Revolution brought something new to human history. Now, all of us know that human wants and human needs are in fact insatiable. But the means for getting the resources and for production and for distribution and consumption to begin to feed those insatiable human wants and needs had not existed until the Industrial Revolution and beyond. And now it seemed that those means were in hand, or at least if they weren't yet, they would be. So, and here's what I want to say. What came about was a cultural confidence which was just as tenacious and impervious to change as religious faith often is. And that cultural confidence had this kind of cluster. Nature could be controlled, tamed and controlled. Society could be managed for abundance and for leisure. The ancient albatrosses of hunger and poverty could simply be heaved seaward. The long-sought answer to gnawing social problems was in reach, and it was more, simply more. Society was, the cultural creed came to claim, assembling the requisite means with science and technology, first harnessing them to each other, and then harnessing them to industry, that would make a habit of toppling all sorts of long-standing barriers to progress. I think 100 years from now, we'll look back on the arguments and the conflict between industrial socialism and industrial capitalism, and we'll just smile and shake our heads that we carried on a Cold War thinking that those two were the arch enemies of one another. Because while the chief antagonists for this 100 years, industrial socialism and industrial capitalism, each were praising the merits of its own system and declaring the certain demise of the other, both of them were achieving quantum leaps in production, distribution, consumption of goods and services, and were building materialist societies on the ground of both. So while each society decreed the calamitous character of the other one, the numbers of the people who entered the ranks of the materially blessed kept climbing in both of them. And the problems are ending up being very much the same kinds of problems, including environmental ones. Material output and economic expansion seemed to care very little about the ideological battles of people who were doing very much the same sort of thing. It'll be interesting, well, you and I won't see it, but it'll be interesting to see what the perspective is, because this is a general Western phenomenon. Okay, next point is that what was first a kind of surprise for Lincoln, that so much could be achieved by material growth, came to be depended upon not only to meet our subsistence needs, food, clothing, shelter, came to be depended upon to solve social problems. So that wars on poverty were launched to be financed not by taking from the already affluent. That's vitally important. We do not solve problems of poverty by taking from the already affluent, but from the so-called growth dividend of an expanding economy. So we have devised a strategy, or we have depended upon one, which says the rich need not give up their place of privilege in order that the poor may enter the ranks of the well-being. We have depended upon material growth to provide a surplus, bake a bigger pie. United Nations development decades were declared to be accomplished not by a transfer of a portion of the rich nation's wealth to the poor nations, but by raising the nations of the poor in the ongoing economic growth of the rich nations, so that the boats of the poor would simply join the flotilla of the advanced industrial nation. even war itself was to be attacked at the point of its prevention, not by socializing away human sin, but by removing discontent and conflict with the sure cure of plenty for all. That's the kind of confidence we've had. So that affluence came to be counted upon to banish those conflicts which were endemic to the competition for scarce goods. What I'm saying is that we have come, the modern world, to tie our hopes to that explosion of production that followed the Industrial Revolution. And only now are we becoming aware of the degree to which we have put our confidence in ongoing material growth. Our institutions are simply organized for that. Now, what I want to say when I get to the end is something of the assumptions and the values that course through the churches as well as the society in general. This golden optimism of an unbounded culture has been captured again and again in our language. And I just picked one example from more recent times, from the Kennedy years, the new frontier. A lovely, lovely phrase to show what kind of mindset has been achieved over the course of this 200-year boom. For most societies, certainly for pre-industrial societies, the word frontier designates a limit. It designates a stopping point. The word frontier means a foreboding and a forbidding place, something that's uninhabitable and uninviting. The word frontier means a halting edge to conquest and control. The word frontier meant making do with what you had. But for the expanding Western world, and for America in particular, frontier has come to mean virtually the opposite. It means not the stopping place, but the starting place. It means an invitation to conquest and an invitation to control. It means a challenge to expansion. And it's meant, above all, not making do with what you have, but the acquiring of more. More land, more resources, more wealth, more room, more opportunities. It's interesting, just with a word, how the meaning has changed so little, so much. So when one frontier is closed for us, what we have to do is open a new frontier. So that's what President Kennedy called us to do. That's our mindset. And this in turn then already feeds what is in fact an expansive spirit. Basically, Americans have a mindset of an overcoming, constant overcoming of limits. So we Americans conquer space. Just think about what that means, conquering space. And the enormity of space on the one hand, and the sense of conquering it on the other hand. Or we wage, again, a frontier, war on poverty. Johnson's Great Society program. We carry a deeply ingrained attitude of the unlimited. More of most anything will always be available, and if it isn't yet, we'll manage the future so that we'll make it so. It's since World War II that we have really fed this sense of the limitless horizons of an ambitious people. I want to quote from the Rockefeller panel papers, which were papers that came out of the 1950s that were kind of unofficial white papers on the American future. And rather prestigious people who put together the Rockefeller panels. This particular quotation is one from some panelists' names whom you may recognize: Henry Kissinger, Dean Rusk, and Arthur Burns.
What's the date?
The 1950s. I'm not exactly sure when this particular one was written. Now, you all listen here for a minute. Here. New technologies, more efficient extraction processes, new uses may open up new worlds. There we go, frontiers again. Even now we can discern the outlines of a future in which, through the use of the split atom, our resources of both power and raw material will be limitless. We are only on the verge of a new age of science. The world may well be on the verge of a major revolution in available energy. The same perspective just glistens on the pages of a 1962 report by the National Academy of Sciences to President Kennedy. During President Truman's time, there was a commission called the Paley Commission that recommended that the United States pursue the conservation of scarce resources. Now, this National Academy of Science report tells President Kennedy that because we are on the verge of such dramatic increases in energy and the food, the United States should change from that Paley Commission report from a philosophy of conservation to, quote, one of the wise management of plenty, end of quote. As then Secretary of the Interior Udall said, such statements are only those of a people that felt it had an omnipotent science, a limitless technology, unending resources, and a course of unbounded affluence well in hand. Well, some of you are Buckminster Fuller buffs, probably, and this paragraph is from the late 60s. And the late 60s began to show some breaks with this mindset of an unlimited, an unbounded spirit. But it doesn't show up here in Buckminster's 1967 paper. He said then, humanity's mastery of vast, inanimate, inexhaustible energy sources and the accelerated doing more with less of sea, air, and space technology have proven Malthus to be wrong. Comprehensive physical and economic success for humanity may now be accomplished in 1/4 of a century. Now think back, if you think from 1967, 25 years, whether you think the chances of comprehensive physical and economic success for humanity might be achieved in 1/4 of a century. The 60s only reinforced this expansive mood. And with the steady increase of affluence set an agenda that was in keeping with our national spirit. And it's really a spirit of the West, but it has a particular American cast, and because we're Americans, I'm focusing on that. But I'll just read to you the agenda that I recall from the President Kennedy and Johnson. Call the nation to go to the moon, feed the world's hungry, assist the poor nations to industrialize, eliminate poverty within our borders, be the mainstay of the defense of the non-communist world, and contain communism in Southeast Asia. That's a rather ambitious agenda. But you have a century and more of a kind of no-limit spirit that has fed that. In 1969, in July, a crowning achievement occurred. U.S. astronauts took, as we said, a giant step for mankind onto the moon. President Nixon at that time called it, quote, the greatest week in the history of the world since creation, end of quote. And a NASA official said it demonstrated that we were masters of the universe. Millions felt that it meant that we could do anything that we set our minds to do. I mean, after that, you couldn't even say the sky's the limit anymore. We sort of punctured that limit, and now we were conquering space as masters of the universe. Okay. I want to just read what I think are some assumptions, and then I'll shut up. Now, I've skipped over 30 pages, so the assumptions are broader than those pages that I, these attempts to reflect the mindset. And I think they are assumptions which hold for modern industrial society as a whole, whether capitalist or socialist. I think they've been held by Americans, including American Christians, with particular tenacity. As a cluster, they have comprised what has been, for all practical purposes, a kind of secular religion and ethic. that has bound together the most diverseful faithful. Political and economic liberals and conservatives. It's a secular religion and ethic in the industrial West that has bound together, and in America that has bound together the Democrats, Republicans, and independents of various stripes, both bosses and workers, both rich and poor, races and ethnic groups of all kinds, establishmentarians and dissidents. So that if these assumptions that I want to try and ferret out of this 200-year boom are subject to doubt and under severe challenge, then a whole culture is under fire. Okay, I'll just read these. Nature has a virtually infinite storehouse of resources that are there for human use, we have assumed. Humanity has the commission to control nature, we have assumed. Humanity has the right and the obligation to use both renewable and non-renewable resources for an ongoing improvement in the standard of material living, or in the material standard of living, we have assumed. We have also assumed that the most effective way to attain individual and social betterment is through the elevation of material standards of living. We have assumed that the most effective way to assure the continuing elevation of material standard of living is through ongoing economic growth. We have assumed that the quality of life itself is furthered by an economic system which is directed to ever-expanding material abundance. We have assumed that the future is open, that systematic material progress for the whole human race is possible, and that through the careful use of human powers, humanity can make history turn out right. We have assumed that human failures can be overcome through effective problem solving, and that problem solving will be effective if reason and goodwill are present and science and technology are imaginatively developed and applied. We have assumed that modern science and technology have helped achieve a superior civilization in the West. We have assumed that what can be scientifically known and technologically done ought to be known and to be done. We have assumed that the good life is one of productive labor and material well-being. We have assumed that the successful person is the achiever. We have assumed that both social progress and individual interest are best served by competitive achievement-oriented behavior. We have assumed that a work ethic is essential to human satisfaction and essential to social progress. We have assumed that the diligent, the hardworking, and the educated will attain their goals. And we have assumed that there is freedom in material abundance. That is to say, that when people have more, their freedom of choice is expanded and they will be more. So that quality of life is closely tied to material abundance. I think those have been some, at least, of the cultural taken for granteds that have driven Americans for very long stretches of what has been an exhilarating journey to material abundance. They kind of belong together as a mindset and a guidance system. If you puncture one of them, you don't necessarily wound very much, because they belong together as a kind of complex that represents a sort of guidance system, a cultural guidance system. It shapes our policy. It shapes our actions. The power of these assumptions derives from the fact they interact and reinforce one another, and we carry on in terms of them, and that in turn feeds them. If they're highly questionable, then the whole matrix is challenged, and not simply one assumption or the other. Lest I lose what is the main point, something of this mindset of a spirit of no limits, a future that is open, a confidence in the material progress of the whole human race, a sense of an unbounded culture, and this set of assumptions is, I hope, part of an explanation of the rich world's wealth. I think that our civilization is one that is simply driven by such a constellation that goes deep into our psyche. Probably no civilization prior to modern industrial society had the occasion to believe so seriously over such a long period of time in the systematic material progress of the whole human race. Nor have many civilizations driven themselves so relentlessly toward that goal. Few civilizations have been so obsessed with replacing what is with what ought to be, according to our vision. So we think nothing of simply and utterly transforming any given landscape, for example, or so tenacious about imposing our designs upon both nature and society. I suspect that no civilization has known so little genuine tranquility either. Certainly none has so taxed the Earth's resources in such a limited period of time. Well, I didn't see anybody jump up and down, but I know that time is up. Can we get some discussion? The questions that I had jotted down are these. Is this rough description of a mindset and a cluster of assumptions in the first place true? Are there corrections? Are there additions? Are there other things that we believe and that we share that help explain the rich world's wealth and maybe the poor world's poverty? That should be added to these? What do you think of these? How do these explain our wealth and maybe someone else's poverty? Another whole set of questions has to do with the way in which Christian faith, as we have understood it, has been a part of this. I think it very definitely has, and we'll talk about that in some detail. Carol,
just as a way of underscoring your analysis, which I think is exactly right and sort of identifies the crucial issues of our time, the notion of the inexhaustibility of nature is very, very old. It's sort of the cornerstone of Greek ethics.
Yeah.
And it's only in very recent times that,
yeah,
that in Western civilization is beginning to come to grips with the falseness of that. But the attitude toward nature has characterized the development of Western civilization. I mean, this,
yes,
particular attitude toward nature that you thought of in this very beginning. It seems to me an important development happened with the rise of the social sciences and the idea of progress. There we really believe that perfection and the resolution of all sorts of social problems would be possible. But the most interesting and frightening thing happened with the marriage of science and technology. And that can perhaps be best illustrated by the opinion given, although I didn't think it was an opinion, even very recently, this year, by Herman Kahn, who, when he was questioned on the business of limited resources and energy resources, simply said that the amazing thing about any technological approach to this is that you always do discover resources that you've never heard of. even very recently, this year, by Herman Kahn, who, when he was questioned on the business of limited resources and energy resources, simply said that the amazing thing about any technological approach to this is that you always do discover resources that you've never heard of.
Mm-hmm.
Even though geologists can't tell us where any more oil fields are, even though we don't know now how to grow enough food and so on, we needn't worry about that,
mm-hmm.
That it will be produced and technology is going to take care of it.
Mm-hmm.
So that what has happened is we've developed a really blind faith in the efficacy of technology to sort of bail us out. So that this original Greek assumption has been made more and more, I think, dangerous as technology has gotten to be one of the formative determinants of our country.
One of the interesting things is that, and you pointed to it, is that in our ethics, which come out of both Hebrew and Greek resources, at one point the Greek triumphed over the Hebrew. And there are some Hebrew elements in this as well. But almost all Western ethics have been anthropocentric, have been human-centered. It's only very recent, that is to say, that the realm of the non-human world, of nature, was not regarded as a realm of moral concern. What counted was, in thinking about human responsibility, was one's responsibility to fellow human beings. And the responsibility to the non-human world was simply not within the circle of one's understanding of moral responsibility. And we're just starting to find out now what this simple assumption that the scope of our responsibility, how it's working out, that restriction to the field of human interaction, how that is working out. Going back to the Bible study, there isn't a notion in most Western ethics, including our American ethics, including our American Christian ethics, of the land having a Sabbath before the Lord. I mean, the land, nature, is really a stage.
The means to the end.
A stage for the human story, which is what really counts. And nature provides resources for the human enterprise. And our ethics have been, by and large, restricted to human interaction, or in Christian ethics, the relationship between God and humanity, but not God, humanity, nature within one circle of moral responsibility. And that's getting us into all kinds of trouble. We don't know how to talk about the rights, if that even makes sense, of trees. We're trying to fumble our way in that direction now, but we don't have a heritage that helps us a whole lot. You know, you might say, "Let trees have standing," as the name and title of a book, but we don't really know how to talk about
that. Even if you want to continue to conceive of morals wholly in terms of the human enterprise, what we're beginning to understand now is that the kind of interaction between man and nature is such that there will be consequences which will shape the possibilities of the human enterprise in a way that never was understood when it was believed that nature was utterly inexhaustible. But you see, the dangerous thing is Herman Kahn's sort of insertion of technology as a way of denying the sort of...
What technology has done essentially is amplify human powers enormously. And so if you take the same set of assumptions of the sort of driving spirit and you add technology, what you do is provide a kind of means that wasn't there before. Yeah, Ralph?
The classic story, of course, would be to Mixel and all this technology and pride in it would be the Tower of Babel. They were able to make breakthrough, even though they didn't have any stolen structural things. And I don't think that that in itself was what was wrong. the technology. I don't think that it was wrong for them to build a city. They made great improvements and all that. I guess the problem, it would seem to me, where they overstepped the limit would be when they said, now we are making a name for ourselves and guaranteeing our own existence. And that's why the Lord seems to put his tongue in his cheek. I don't think he is at all
threatened
by it when he says, if they succeed in this, there is nothing that shall be withheld from them that they will not do, you know. But then he does bring the judgment. At the same time, I think that the marvelous part in Genesis 1:11, chapter 9, we had it in the Bible class last week, where God says, be fruitful, multiply, doesn't say have dominion, but it says the fear of you and the dread of you befall all creatures. But then he puts a secret limit there, that they can't simply slaughter them, make their path through the world blood. And puts a limit so they can domesticate animals and they can use the meat for their own consumption. But the blood, which is the root of life, has to first get the order of and so you have a certain that whole theology there, Genesis 1:2-11 is both and big ambiguity. So on one hand, I wouldn't be against the technology, it's where this fits in to our present problems. I'm quite sure God will take care of this one way or another. No question about
that. Yeah, and then Myra, go ahead.
The one thing that bothers me about all of this is that I don't really see any, I agree with the assumptions that you were suggesting, I don't see any really adequate counter assumptions arising in what at least I would know about the rest of the world. You say these are Western assumptions.
Well.
And the problem that I see is that when you certainly have nature religions where something is done before something is done to a tree, that's a sacrifice or something is done. But we in the Western world aren't about ready to honor that kind of an approach. Because you can see that in the other parts of the world there has been a wasting of the world's resources out of simple ignorance, like denuding forests and letting the desert encroach from the Sahara into the Sahel. Other things of this nature, and I just wonder where, and maybe that's what you're coming to tomorrow, but I don't
I'm
see
sure it'll be later than that, but
okay.
Not yet tomorrow.
Well, I'm leaving on Sunday.
You don't have much time.
Then you better get out. No, I mean, part of the dilemma is that this cluster of assumption is called into question and severely challenged. An alternative, a kind of, sort of rural romanticism compounded by ignorance in so many parts of the world doesn't offer anything better. In fact, it's worse. And we're kind of groping in a time between times for a different cluster of assumptions and a different mindset, and we don't have that. You know, I think that's part of the real problem at present, in closing the gap between rich and poor, because neither the rich nor the poor have that blueprint.
Larry, I think that's a correct assessment. The analysis leads us to a kind of despair, but the alternative replacement for that, what produces that despair, isn't really there. Yeah. Ghetto, in his book, comes up with very much the same analysis that you do, Larry. He weaves in the contribution of the Judeo-Christian tradition also to shape the West. And that's another whole area of discussion that fascinates me. To what extent is this view of history, of the divine human interaction, of economic success, a part of what was fueled by the Christian or the biblical message? And yesterday we were talking about it, Herb said it's not just Judeo-Christian, it's also Muslim, that view. In contrast to the Eastern and Southern world and traditional culture and tribal faiths. Ghetto, who's an Italian priest in this book, Why is the Third World Poor, which is in the bookstore over here, is on the book list we're going to hand out in a few minutes. He says that there has been both good and evil in this. This engine of a different way of viewing human and natural realities has fueled this advance in the West. And the Southern Hemisphere now wants it, but he fears that they'll want it with all of the ills that it brings. And he talks about some of the papal writings, John the 23rd and Paul the 6th, to talk about development in terms of both material and spiritual quality. And he says basically in the West we've abandoned the spiritual as part of development. Economic development is material only. Now he's not terribly hopeful that the Southern Hemisphere will do any better than the Northern Hemisphere has with that. But he would like to retain some of the qualities of the Southern Hemisphere cultures, a sense of community in place of competition, a sense of responsibility and maybe more of a stewardship orientation toward material resources. He's afraid that they'll take the worst of the Western model and give up the best of their own. Mm-hmm. And that's the dilemma, I think. Mm-hmm. But he sees that there are good things that ought to be preserved in those cultures that we would call more static economically.
Yeah. Incidentally, next week, I would like to try using some biblical and theological reflections to talk about a different mindset or a different frame of reference.
You'll just have to come back.
I don't know what you're going to do about that. Myron?
To tie in last week with a little bit from this, I was struck by the use of the word frontier. Mm-hmm. Because there are some denominations that have risen to massive size in this country who have taken that definition of the frontier as the primitive area where man may go and exploit, and in his exploiting, develop the kingdom of God on earth. But there were other denominations, of which Lutheranism is a part, that reflect that European definition of the word frontier, that is the frightful place, and that if you do go out there, you must bring your cultural traditions with you. And perhaps in those denominations with that kind of a mindset, there is the possibility then of not becoming completely victimized by this last 200 years of Industrial Revolution. But there's a greater tradition in there than those which have dropped traditions and try to create within the given mindset a new Christianity.
Yeah, I think that most of those traditions, though, have been overwhelmed.
Well, they've been eroded by the pietism, which has placed the emphasis on the individual.
Yeah.
And the individual has become acculturated to the mindset of the time.
Yeah.
But I would also suggest that you raise the question, are there those of another mindset? And I'm struck by the utopian community that we have around here. The Hutterites, which are very technological, or the Amish, which have denied technology, and yet there is very definitely a cure of the earth, not a rape of the earth, that's involved in both of those societies.
Yeah. Yeah, you start looking at minority traditions, and you find an astounding number of them in your own culture that are very suggestive. You don't take them as models, you know, but they're very suggestive, and that tradition in American society of some of the utopian communities represents one stream. I think that much of the Old Testament materials represents within Christian faith all sorts of alternatives to the way in which we've viewed things, and that's part of our own heritage, but it's a forgotten tradition or it's a neglected one. And so you get both contemporary and past resources out of things which are in fact your own roots.
Well, then a plug for next hour, because we're going to be taking a look at the concept of new thought, and we come up with the 1950s with Dwight Eisenhower. I'll start out with Eisenhower, you start out with I'll work with Eisenhower, and the religious spokesman of that day, Norman Vincent Peale. Huh. And you get another form of religious sanctification of the thing that you're deploring.
Hmm.
The power of positive thinking.
Yeah.
But it's not dead in the 50s. It's very alive in the 70s.
Oh, yes.
Now only it's called possibility.
Yeah, yeah. Develop your infinite potential.
The church growth movement uses the word growth, which is peculiarly American, too. Peculiarly American.
So this idea, though, we may be coming to a transitional period in the 70s, yet in the pew, there is still a strong longing for that optimistic 50s.
Yeah, yeah.
In that book that you were citing, Why the Third World is Poor, how do you use the word poor? Do they mean in terms of not enough of anything, not of food, but in terms of industrial poor, or what is the poor?
Economics, the problem of survival with basic human needs being met is the way he uses it, the conventional way, because he says the third world really is very rich in many ways, where we are poor. But it's the conventional economic meaning of the term that he uses. It's
so
translated from the Italian, so I don't know what the original title was. But it's,
so is he saying poor is not necessarily bad?
Well, he's saying it's bad if it leads to starvation and struggle to maintain life beyond 5 years or 30 or 40 years. Yeah, he's saying that's bad. But how can you have that taken care of, as the West is pretty well managed, without giving up the richness in community and care for the extended family and the communitarian ethic as opposed to the competitive ethic?
Okay, another question. Who would be put in the third world? For instance, now, would China would not be in because do they consider China not poor because they are being able to feed their people and giving them their basic needs? Or does he use third world only in terms of economic poor? China is not industrialized in that sense of policy.
Well, terms are kind of funny, where we had once a first and a second world, the East and the West, the capitalist and the socialist world, then we started talking about a third world that was non-aligned, and that has come to mean the Southern Hemisphere, roughly speaking. He's really talking in terms of a dual world, North and South, rich and poor, which is a rough meat cleaver kind of analysis, but you know, basically it's a tool that people can use, a conceptual tool. So the third world, which is really two-thirds of the population of the earth, is the low-income peoples, the low-income countries. And then you could say, well, some of that exists within the United States, and it does.
Yeah.
You know. So it's raw, north-south, rich-poor kind of categorizing.
Are we going to add some of those assumptions you make in terms of deciding, for instance, whether our work ethic is something that is bad?
Yes, and I don't want to leave this session simply by laying this out and having people assume that whatever is the opposite is the proper alternative. I don't want to say no growth represents the solution, or anti-technology ought to be our proper mood, or that the work ethic has no place or meaning or value anymore. I don't want to do that. I do want to say that this particular cluster has driven us, and I think it gets us increasingly in trouble. So you need to start looking at the parts and see what different, sort of like the kaleidoscope, and see what different mosaic you might get out of many of the same pieces.
Larry, I think
there's a voice from heaven.
Oh.
Yes. Okay.
I think one of the things that this kind of hour points to, there was a French historian who always wrote three histories when he wrote, and said there are always those going on. One is the newspaper headlines that cover the event of the day, and that is history. I mean, a historian can deal with it. There's also a kind of institutional history. The shapings and the clusters of people and their institutions also form the history. And I'm not sure you can say surface and intermediary and deeper, but there was a history values, mindset, assumption, worldview, and in some sense, if you can find that history, you know that institutions and headlines will somehow live that out, but there is that history, and we don't often do that. I think that whether these assumptions will be changed to other assumptions we can come today, I think more and more people feel we're at that point where there is really not only new questions and answers, but even a new way to ask the question, that we're in a shift. In the last 4 years, I found lots of people who disagreed on the list and disagreed a lot on the solution, but shared a kind of inner feeling that we're in a time when things are really going to...
I've noticed with enormous interest that it has been particularly two groups of people that have been driving the rest of us to go deeper. There are essentially three kinds of change that are being called for. One is technological change. We need a more sophisticated technology, we need some breakthroughs, or we don't have them. Second kind of change is structural or systemic or organizational change, how you organize, put human life together. So they call for systemic changes. But it's the policymakers, and then the scientists and the technologists are the ones that are calling for the third change. And that is a change of perceptions, the way we see things, the way we understand things, the value level.
Consciousness.
Yeah, and that third kind of change has been coming from precisely the folks who have become, worked with the first two kinds of change and said it doesn't go deep enough. Got to get inside our heads and not just out here.
All right, I wonder if we could stop here so that we're finished approximately when the bell rings. That's another kind of pressure that Stevenson didn't talk about.
Lemons.
To look ahead to tomorrow, a couple things I want to hand out. One, for those who didn't get it, the green sheet has on it some questions of a survey nature just to measure where we are collectively. On, I think there's some people in the back who didn't get it. If you'd fill that out and leave it at the back before you leave this room, then we'll collate the responses and tell you how they compare with the general public in the United States and Western Europe. Secondly, tomorrow we're going to talk about the charges from the Third World about the international order, the international system, and how it economically ensures that they will always be poor and the rest will always be rich. And that brings up feelings of guilt, I think, traditionally among the rich, typically. There's a very helpful little word on that from Denis Goulet. It's been helpful to me, and I think it might be to you, which we want to share. And it's on the back, on one side of the goldenrod sheet. On the other side of the goldenrod sheet is another list. Mm-hmm. 10 reasons for choosing a simpler lifestyle from Jürgen Lissner, which many of you have perhaps already discovered. But I think it's helpful to talk about what a reduction in our own consumption in the rich world can and cannot do. What are good reasons for opting for that lifestyle simplification, and what are not good reasons? So that's something you can take with you. If you have a chance to look at it before tomorrow, good. And then the third thing is a list of some books and some films or audiovisuals that relate to the subject matter. And I'll send these around that way. And I want to say a couple things about some of those items. First, most of them are in the bookstore here. And it bothers the bookstore people at Holden when books are ordered by faculty on faculty recommendation and then nobody buys them. Now, I don't want to put you under a load of guilt, but I do want to have you know that there's an opportunity for buying good, fairly inexpensive books. They're all paperbacks.
It also keeps the economy going.
It keeps the economy of Holden healthy. That's right. I don't know if it expands the pie, but it keeps the pie at its present size, at least. One set of things that you probably already know about is the whole Club of Rome set. There are three of those now, three reports of the Club of Rome. Mankind at Limits to Growth was the first. Title is significant, very significant. Mankind at the Turning Point, and a third one which just came out last year, Reshaping the International Order. I do not think those are in the bookstore, but those are available generally in libraries. Then Ghetto's book, Why is the Third World Poor, which I find very stimulating and helpful. And he doesn't deal only with the internal factors within the poor nations. He deals with the external factors, the heritage of colonialism, which is what we're going to talk about tomorrow. Denis Goulet, The Uncertain Promise. Goulet is a Roman Catholic development ethicist who's written a lot of things. This is his latest. This deals with intermediate technology, kind of E.F. Schumacher stuff. Value conflicts in technology transfer of technology from north to south. Michael Harrington's book, which is in hardcover, is very new, is in the library, not the bookstore. And I have a copy with me, and there's a copy back on the table there which you can check out. The best, most popular thing I've found to interpret how the present world economic problem came to be, the 19th century history of economic colonialism. He's the one who wrote The Other America 15 years ago that led to popular understanding that created the war on poverty in this country. He writes very well for the layperson, like as most of us are in these areas.
Yeah, Lester Brown.
This is not on the list, but Lester Brown's new book, The 29th Day, really talks about the environmental, population, food, energy set of problems that faces the world. 29th Day comes, the title comes from an old, I think, French story, which says if it takes 30 days, if the lily pond has, if the growth of lilies covering the pond, the growth doubles every day, and we're at the point where only half of the pond is covered, we figure we still have a lot of time left, right? Half the pond is covered, half is not covered. But in fact, we're at the 39th day, because the pond covers in 30 days. So we're at the 11th hour, 5 minutes to midnight, that's where the title 29th day comes from. We think we still got a lot of time. In fact, we're at the
stroke before midnight, because it's an exponential kind of growth. Okay. I have a copy of this with me. I don't know if it's in the library. I don't think so. It just appeared. Schumacher's book you know about, that is in the bookstore, right? Small is Beautiful. Dennis Shoemaker, The Global Connection, is on order. Oh, is it here? Okay. That's a good one for dealing with how local groups have tried to deal with global problems, the local global connection. Ron Sider's book is the best thing I've found for Christians to deal with the biblical material related to rich and poor. Until Larry's book appears.
Yeah.
And I'm coming to that. Ron Sider's book is in the bookstore. It's very good for conservative Christians particularly. He writes out of a conservative evangelical context with a radical social analysis. Oh, it's the next one on the list, Mary. Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger.
You knew that, Mary.
She just wants every title to get mentioned. The next one, Robert Stivers, a religion prof at PLU, deals with some of what Larry talked about this morning, ethics for a time of economic plateauing, not growth, but what do you do, what is an ethical way to go when the pie isn't getting any bigger. The Sustainable Society, that's in the bookstore. Finally, John Taylor, finally on this side, John Taylor, Enough is Enough, I think the best popular treatment of the biblical witness on consumption. Mm-hmm. Then on the back side, it's a theology of sufficiency, or a theology of enough, that he's laying out. On the back side, the new book, if you want to get the 30 pages that we're missing this morning, if you want the whole list of assumptions, they're all in this new book, which Larry and Bruce Birch have co-authored, mm-hmm. The Predicament of the Prosperous. It's to appear in November of 78, and Larry may want to say another word about it in addition to what's here. Sentence or two.
Just that it's an effort to treat two gaps, the gap between rich and poor, and the gap between human well-being and environmental well-being, and not only the rich-poor problem, and to address resources from Christian faith to both of those gaps as we experience them, both questions of social justice and what's sometimes called eco-justice.
I haven't read it, but I've heard parts of it the last two summers in these presentations Larry and I have done. It's at least a good book, and it's probably a great book. So watch for it, buy it. If you come back to Holden next summer, it'll probably be here on the shelves. And then John and Mary Schramm's book, which in my mind combines a number of elements of what we've been dealing with here. The need for a contemplative life, the need for social action, and the need for responsible behavior in our consumption patterns, our style of life. That's in the bookstore. Audiovisuals, I promised many of you an address for getting The Glass House. It's available in some other film libraries, but I know it's available here because they distribute it in this country. And the other item, Sharing Global Resources, is a slide sound show, which I hope we can arrange to share next week in some evening time. It deals with the international economic order, particularly U.S. Latin America.